Welcome to CFO 4.0, the future of finance. The CFO role is changing rapidly, moving from cost controller to strategic visionary. And with every change comes opportunity. We are here to help you take advantage of this transition to win at work, drive your career forwards, and lead with confidence. Join Hannah Munro, Managing Director of ITAS, a financial transformation consultancy, as she interviews key experts to give you real-world advice and guidance on how to transform your processes, people, and data. Welcome to CFO 4.0, the future of finance.
So hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of CFO 4.0. I have a treat for our listeners. So you may remember a previous guest of ours, so James Owen, who is the global CFO of the Profiles division at Kantar. So he is back with us to talk to talk about a few different topics. So welcome, James. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I had a lot of fun last time.
So did I, and I had some great feedback from our podcast. So if you listeners wonder whether it's worth reaching out to give me thoughts and commentary and feedback on these episodes, it definitely is, because I do actually listen and feedback. So James, just for those that perhaps haven't heard the last session, or maybe it's been a while since they listened to it. So could you give us a bit of a background about yourself and perhaps some of the recent stuff you've done as well?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm more of a commercial finance professional than a more of a technical finance person. So most of my career has been spent in retail and FMCG and sort of high growth scale up kind of organizations. So until the last 2.5 years, that's where I was. And then I re-entered the large blue chip space with Kantar about 2.5 years ago. So my role is to look after the profiles division, as you kindly said earlier on. So Kantar is a global market research firm, big, big company. We touch tens of thousands of large organizations around the world. And we advise companies how to do their marketing, how to bring a new product to the marketplace, etc. And we do that by having a very, very large panel of humans around the world that we understand deeply and can ask questions to. And the Profiles division is that part of the business. We've got over 7 million panelists around the world that we engage with on a daily, hourly, minute basis as well. So we get this incredibly rich data, analyze it, and then pass on the best possible advice from there. So my journey has been helping that business transform. Yeah, we came out of the WPP group about 3.5-4 years ago now, and we're going through our own investment journey with Bain Capital, and coming out over the other end as an even more efficient, beautiful beast, with a real platform for growth.
Hey, so it sounds like it's an exciting time. And we did touch quite a bit on transformation last time. But one of the topics that we were chatting at just before we started the podcast was all about how things are different, because it does feel like we're in a completely different economic environment than they were just 18 months ago. And the bit I still can't get my head around is how fast it's changed. And so it'd be interesting to see, like, what are some of the changes that you've seen and felt within, within the economic space, and how has that impacted how you see finance and how you're reacting within finance?
I think one of the first things, we've always known cash is king, right? Mm. But the reality is that with the current interest rate environment, cash flow has never been more important than ever before. And so many organizations around the world have become very heavily reliant on low interest debt and leverage-based growth. And the reality is a lot of that debt is coming up for refinancing now. And all of a sudden, that is hitting companies' ability to trade, let alone further fuel growth. What we're seeing, because of the way our organization works, we are very plugged in to many organizations in many countries. So we get a really good inside track barometer of where the economy is at right now. And what we're seeing right now is there a lot of the lead indicators, and I think lead versus lag is probably a topic we should talk about later, but the lead indicators indicate, sadly, a recession's coming. and a global recession. And I know a lot of the economic commentators would like you to believe that we've turned a corner. That's not what we're seeing. And what we're seeing on a regular basis now is that there's a real landscape change in the way organizations are, their attitude toward money and their investment cycle. So a good example is we're seeing a shift toward bite size. So historically, if a piece of work used to run for 12 months of the year, they're dividing it up into four, for example, and repitching all four of those. So you've got to get used to a world where you might not win one of the four. And that, for me, really speaks to the UK supermarket scene 15 years ago. So where you had your one big monthly shop and you were brand loyal to whichever blue, green, orange, yellow, dark green brand that you particularly liked at the time. Over time, we shifted toward the weekly convenience shop. I was at Sainsbury's and Asda at the time. You knew you weren't going to get all those baskets. So that is a very clear trend now. And on top of that, there's a much more ruthless approach to nice to haves versus must haves. And the space in the market for nice to haves has dried up significantly, because that's the sacrifices that are being made right now for organizations to have comfort in their immediate term. So it's definitely a changing landscape.
And it's interesting, and I think, you know, I think that's one of the challenges is actually how as individuals in finance do we get or start getting visibility and access to, like you say, those leading indicators versus the lagging? Because by the time you've got into lag, it's in some ways it can be too late. So what does that mean for how we should approach the finance aspect? What should CFOs be considering and thinking about given those indicators and what you just said?
I think one of the basics is the importance of scenario planning. And so I've said this a few times recently. I've been looking to do a bit of the speaking circuit. And I have an opinion, which seems to be shared by the community, that scenario planning historically was intellectual stroking. You know, it was a trapdoor mechanism for here's what I want to present. And here's an upside and a downside versus that, which are too unrealistic that you're going to land on what I want to present.
Yeah.
So scenario planning didn't massively have a real place in the world. But what I'm now recommending, and I am seeing this across a lot of other people, is that scenario planning now has a place. You almost want to have three different ranges. You want an ambition level, which you set your company goals toward. You have a realism level, which you set your annual budgets toward. And you have a prudence level, which you set your cash flow forecast based on. And I think if you follow that three-stage philosophy, you're going to be okay, broadly speaking. Whether that leads to perpetual scenario planning and the concept of integrated business planning, that's an organizational choice. But the critical thing is this is consensus led as well. I don't think we can have a navel gazing view of scenario planning anymore. It has to be a handheld paw print on this across the organization. And I think that way you can at least give yourself a little bit of wiggle room.
And the challenge I think a lot of CFOs have is that, you know, there is a huge amount of ambition that comes from the CEO, that comes from the sales director, and depending on where you're at in your funding cycle, sometimes the investors as well. So how do you look at, or how do you think about balancing sometimes the competing priorities or other influences on the planning cycle with, like you say, the realism aspect and making sure that it's something that is achievable?
My philosophy is that it has to be achievable. Like I don't believe in budgeting based on hope. I don't think you can get there. I think context is also a critical element to take into consideration here. So back in the retail sector, the grocery retail sector 15 years ago again, the key thing we talked about actually wasn't our own growth. It was the IGD, the industry growth differential. So it's all very well and good looking at your own results and saying, I grew by 4%, hey, high five. Or I grew by 10%, or I went backwards by 1% this one. What actually mattered was, what was the sum of the market doing? And therefore, what was your delta versus that? So if you grew by 4% and the marketplace grew by 2%, you've outperformed by 2. That's a good performance. If you've gone, if you've grown by 4 and the market did 10, you're minus 6. And actually, you've left money on the table. And I think that kind of wider lens and keeping your tentacles out there and knowing what's going on in the marketplace is essential to bring someone on a journey. I feel too often there's still a focus on putting your truth out there, which is incredibly integrity led, and hoping it sticks in the boardroom sometimes. The reality is, it's not what's said, it's what's heard. And you know, having the right to say I told you so months later is pointless. It doesn't help anybody. So I think you've got to bring people on that journey as to why this is your recommendation, because it's the right path to follow.
Gosh, there's so much in that short sentence that we need to explore. So let's just start with the core piece. So you talked about obviously using the market as your delta, as your point of comparative. Mm. Where would you normally go to access that kind of information? You know, because you remember you've got finance individuals from small businesses all the way up to large enterprise listening in. So what are your recommendations or ways to understand how other companies of your size and industry are performing?
I think it absolutely depends on your sector and the size of your organization. And I don't want this to be an advert, but when I was in the retail space, we actually used Kantar. So Kantar published that data and owned that data. That isn't the case for all industries. So it entirely depends on your space. I think a lot of medium plus size companies will have some level of competition that are probably listed in some form. Now, it's not always easy to pick out, if you've got more of a divisional lens, the direct comparable part of that. But you can usually get one or two proxies for how you're performing versus somebody else. It gets a lot harder when you get smaller and more boutique. I get that. I entirely get that. But that's where I think the power of networking comes in. I find that if you have a peer-to-peer conversation, people are relatively open. They're not giving you anything particularly confidential, but they'll give you enough to get a sense of their direction of travel as well. And sometimes that's enough. All you want to know deep down is, contextually, are we walking the right path?
Yeah, and could we have done better? Could we have, you know, are we above where we need to be? And asking yourself that question.
Exactly.
And in terms of, you said an interesting comment there about what you're saying is not necessarily what is heard. And I think that is a really, really valuable statement. So let's just dig into that. You know, how do you manage that challenge, you know, in terms of what you're putting forwards is not necessarily either what's digested or either what's understood or what's wanted to be heard, I think is sometimes the case.
Absolutely. I think this goes back to who are we in our DNA. Historically, the finance person is probably a slightly shy, introverted, and analytical human. And therefore isn't the one that wants to be jumping up and down on a soapbox trying to dominate an MDC or salesperson who's far more bullish and will want to win their battle ultimately. The historical way has been present your compelling case, put it out there, but you almost don't own the end outcome. You know, your job has finished at that point. I see that as utterly an unacceptable outcome. No, it's like you've been in a restaurant cooking a meal and then failing to let it leave the kitchen. You know, you've done all the hard work, but you've got none of the outcome and the objective that you're looking for in the first place. So for me, it's about personal accountability. You know, you have and storytelling helps, by the way, you know, as a comms style, but you have an obligation to try several different routes of articulating the same thing if it isn't, if the message isn't landing. So yeah, that's certainly what I do. Now, you can help by social strategies, by picking people off in advance, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is, in the room, it's speak then or forever hold your peace, because yeah, that is your obligation, is that you have to ensure the message is understood.
And I think it's an interesting piece about, like you say, there's the, you know, and I think intentionally or unintentionally, like you say, there can be an overly positive attitude to the market, to the outcomes potentially that are coming forwards. And have you got any strategies that you've used in the past to control those conversations? Like you say, having not blindsiding people, having conversations prior, or is there anything else, that any sort of top tips you've got for where you've got a particularly overly ambitious individual within your wider executive team that you've had to manage through?
Yeah, a few times when I worked in FMCG, we had sales and operational planning, which evolved into integrated business planning. And the beauty of that is it's consensus, but it's documented. So what you're capturing is effectively people's predictions. So as long as you've got the process in place to review and learn and iterate, you're able to, over time, quickly build up a bank of who's good at forecasting and who's not. So you can almost have a beta factor, which will dumb up or dumb down someone's prediction calls, and in theory, it improves over time. So it's the way we did it was not very algorithmic; it was a bit quite manual. But I think now you would have some level of software input that would help you achieve that more accurate forecast over time. And I think that eliminates this anecdotal philosophy. You know, like the car salesman, this is how it's always been. I know best because I once sold a Kia in 1993. That's not acceptable anymore.
So let's explore that topic. So tell us about integrated business planning and how you've seen it work well.
Well, for us, I'm going back to my pharmaceutical days here, but sales, S&OP in its heart was really about boxes at that time. So it works better in physical product environment, but it was a forecasting tool for making sure you produce the right boxes, got it to the right warehouse and got it to the right retail at the right time. And you're able to support any peaks or troughs in demand based on commercial activity in store or whatever it may be. Yes, you then often go as far as putting a revenue dollar on it. And sometimes you might even gone as far as gross margin. But where I got to was there is nothing that isn't copy and pastable to the entire organization here. You know, it's good discipline to divide up your entire P&L and have clear management team accountability on every part, every single element of that. Whether it's payroll, is I don't know, the CHRO, or you know, the whatever it may be, and then you have a clear finance business partner man marker for each of those. And at the end of the day, S&OP really is just a monthly meeting to review your actuals and your forward forecast. You can apply that to anything. So we evolved that more toward the integrated business planning concept, which is just doing the same thing, really. But what that gives you is a consensus-based risk and ops-adjusted full P&L on a perpetual basis. That directly, you can almost do scenario planning on the back of that to give you your annual plans or your quarterly reforecasts. But then we even took it a bit further and thought, do you know what? It's only a bit of mathematical formulae here to give you a cash flow forecast as well. And the beauty of that is that you've got a cash flow forecast that's directly based on the P&L. You know, it's not a separately generated piece of work. So that was a piece of work / IP that took about 3 years to evolve, but it was really successful for us. And I've continued to use it to an extent throughout the rest of my career so far. Hopefully we'll continue to do so thereafter, unless you know ChatGPT replaces my concept, which probably can do.
scary what some of the new technology can do. But and I think it'll be an interesting conversation to have in the next couple of years as to, you know, how it helps us build those models and how, or just as importantly, how it helps us adjust those models like more dynamically, because that's always the challenge, isn't it? It's the speed of getting to the end result is sometimes the issue.
And absolutely.
And so with that framework then, so you obviously mentioned it was more product focused. How have you applied that in a less product and more, you know, people-based environment?
So one of my previous roles before Kantar was in a management consultancy. And it worked just as well there. Even though you're talking humans, labor rates, utilization rates, client projects, associates versus employees, etc. It's the same thing still works. You've got the work that you know about and the likely resource adjustments you have to make to fulfill that to the right level. You've got work, you've got your CRM pipeline that you think will probably land at any point in the future. So as long as your revenue officer, your commercial officer, your MD hold hands on that prediction of win rates, etc., you've got a decent understanding from your ops person of the resource required to fulfill, you can still apply the same concepts, even in a professional service environment. So I honestly think it works. It's just this philosophical scenario. It is scenario planning at the end of the day, but it's handheld. It's not a finance only piece of work.
So I always find it really hard to explain to people why they should choose ITAS as their financial transformation or Sage partner. So rather than me tell you how awesome we are, I'm going to let our customers do it.
So we decided to go with ITAS because when we were looking for a partner, we felt that they not only took the time to understand our business and they knew the needs of everyone on the team or everyone that would be using the system, but they also were very transparent in kind of what they could do, what they couldn't do. And prior to having us, you know, sign anything or make any agreements, they held meetings with us to walk them through our processes and our business, so that they really understood everything that would need to be done and give us realistic timelines as well. And another thing was, because we were so new and we didn't have a current system going, we were looking for something that we could implement rather quickly, but also do it correctly. And we felt that ITAS would be able to achieve both of those in terms of, yeah, understanding our business and implementing it how we wanted it, but also doing it in our rather quick timeline.
And how do you incorporate, so obviously, you know, if you've got a fairly short forecast window, absolutely CRM is the way to go, unless you've got some incredibly quick deal cycles. But what about on an extended, like where, you know, you need to look at a more extended forecast, maybe a 6 to 12 month window? How did you manage and support that?
Well, that's where I think data mining and having the more robust toolkit is more appropriate, because you are starting to get more into the second guessing scenario. And anecdote will never be as good as data science. And I think data science is probably an interesting theme to explore in its own right, because it's becoming ever more important in literally everything. And in fact, I'd say we're starting to get to a stage where data science is becoming a threat, I think, to commercial finance individuals. So over time, the world of finance business partner, specifically data science, consultants, MBAs, they're all converging at the same time toward who gives the best advice based on the data in front of me. So I think that's certainly something to be wary of. But ultimately, yeah, I think a long-term sales cycle, a long-term, you know, CRM pipeline, it's still crunching predictive data and then flowing it through the normal pipes.
And that predictive data is based on potentially the current economic climate. And if you think about how our current climate is versus 18 months ago. That's an incredibly fast turnaround. So how did you manage some of the volatility in the market alongside that integrated planning model?
Good. That is a very good question. We are trying, I say we, and by that I mean specifically Kantar, but we are trying to make a big switch toward real-time data. I think this is really the lead lag question as well, to an extent as well. So traditionally, the lag measures are things like the P&L, right? The GDP is, it's kind of a statement of record looking backwards. I don't feel they're particularly fit for purpose anymore. I think we're now living in a world of real-time KPI dashboards with A/B testing and live in the moment cost corrective action. Clear, RASCI, people on dashboards, controls and checks, balances that ladder up to other people. And eventually, if enough things go wrong that look like this over enough time and they pass through enough layers, a red light appears on the CEO's dashboard. But it's the speed of getting to that red light. I think that's wild the difference where we were in the past. And that's a very good thing. But a lot of organizations have to evolve a lot for that not to be a manual process. And so bad news needs to sweep upwards way quicker than it ever has in the past. And it feels a little bit like a NASA control room. It is what an organization needs to look like now. You need a team of data scientists all looking at a very specific thing, which is algorithmically generated, but it's throwing out the odd outlier every now and then that needs investigating. And the idea here is, if you're an astronaut going to the moon, you're not going to realize, you're still going to see the moon, but if you're off by half a degree, you're not going to realize for a day, quite frankly, by which point my math is probably terrible here, but you're potentially 100,000 miles off course. You need one person looking at the third decimal place of degrees to realize that within 10 minutes and course correct. And that's where businesses need to be now.
And that, I'm going to be honest, that exact thing. So I feel like I've been banging the drum for real-time data and visibility. And I love the way you summed up the reason why it's so critical in today's environment. And I genuinely could not have said it better myself in terms of the why. And I think you've really put it into context. I think the challenge for a lot of companies, I guess, is making that shift into that real-time data. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you know, and but that's what excites me about AI. So, and again, having had lots of conversations with some of the technology and some of the AI labs that are sitting behind even like the most commonly used platforms, you know, finance platforms, like what they are doing with AI to kind of drive that course correction and alert is incredible, because their data sets that they're holding is massive, because they're not looking at one company's data. They're analyzing data from multiple entities, from multiple organizations in multiple industries. And obviously it's all anonymized, but it's an exciting piece right now.
It is, but there's good data sets and there's bad data sets. Big data is divided potentially into two sub-buckets. And I think a lot of companies don't necessarily realize they've got bad data sets. So the data science foundation you need in place to do some of this stuff needs to be really organized and policed, quite frankly. You need to have such a clear vision of what the end reporting and KPIs need to look like, therefore working backwards how each transaction needs to be tagged in which ERP around the world, mm-hmm. etc., in order to have comparable and meaningful data at the other side, because otherwise it's rubbish in, rubbish out. And that's a journey we've personally been on. We have multiple ERP systems where we've got the same ERP system. We might have multiple instances of that ERP system. We have optional. We've historically, in some instances, had optional fields, and that makes meaningful data science really challenging on the other side. So it's been a big journey for us to try and correct that. And somehow that's kind of forced its way across my desk.
I wonder why, James. I wonder why.
You need to make it happen. Yeah. Well, you need a passion for it, though, I guess. Mm. And I do have a passion for this.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think, if you don't mind, that's a really interesting conversation to explore, because I talk about data hygiene. I literally did a session this morning on exactly that concept. So talk about how you approach the cleaning up data when, you know, obviously once you've got a clear outcome in terms of a reporting pack that you need to produce, or a type of report that you need to produce, how do you go about assessing the quality of the data and then working through to make sure that you get that data where it needs to be?
I tend to start with what it's a business I used to work with in the past, so the concept called Future Back. And Future Back is as simple as it sounds. It's think about what it needs to look like when it's perfect, and then do your sequential steps. Because if you go the other way, you're going to end up with some weird hybrid that's never going to actually get you there, and you're just going to be disappointed. So for me, it's all about agreeing with all stakeholders. Again, it's kind of an integrated planning consensus concept. Agree with all stakeholders. Is this the suite of reports? Is this the various cuts of data you're ever going to want, whether it's a domain split of revenue, a type of revenue between gross, net, discounts, whatever it may be? Is it intercompany versus external? Is it what split of external have you got? Do you need industries in there? You know, you have to go through that painful moment, and everyone looks at you like you've got three heads at that time. Like, why do they care this much about? We'll work it out. The reality is you don't have time to work it out, because all of this has to exist at the moment the transaction's keyed. That's your key moment. And you can never retrospectively, or it's incredibly inefficient to retrospectively tag these things. So it all has to be done at the single moment in time when you receive that API from a customer, or a salesperson keys something, whatever it may be. That's the moment you have to win. So is that in the finance remit? No. But if I want this to be clean and meaningful, I have to have a passion for that being right in the first place. So I'm not sure I answered the question there, but yeah, for me, it's all about having that clear vision, having your, quite frankly, your house in order. Otherwise, you've got just foundation sand.
And I think if I maybe sum up, because I always think in frameworks. So for me, it's a clear definition of the reporting requirement. And oh my gosh, the amount of conversations I've gone into in just basic, like talking about charts of accounts, and people build charts of accounts from, it's a bit like zero-based budgeting. I'm a big believer in you start with the end goal and you build your chart accounts from that, with the, you know, the reporting requirement, and then you sort of assess it against what what a typical chart of accounts looks like to make sure you haven't missed anything. But that's, for me, is a classic example of, like you say, future back. I like that phrase. I might borrow that. I hope there's no IP around that. I like it.
There is. Shall I call them out and acknowledge it now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's from the Egremont Group, who are a global management consultancy. They're a fantastic piece of work they did. So shout out to Sean Connolly and the team.
Absolutely, love that. So that's a great way of thinking through. So I always say, start with the end in mind, less catchy, but same concept. So thinking through your reporting requirements, then defining your inputs, and then what you're saying is then assessing those inputs to ensure that they are clean enough to deliver on the reporting requirement and in the right format with the right level of data. And it's really interesting that you say about it needs to be right at the beginning. Because like you say, you know, I think that's a really important piece. And if it's not exactly right at the beginning, making sure you've got enough data to manage the allocation or data correction process in the background, that's where things get interesting. So love that as a framework and a concept and something for everyone to think about when they're going in. So kind of going back to what we were talking about in terms of integrated business planning and dealing with this really volatile environment, is there anything else that you're considering in your role about how you ensure the, you know, the stability, I guess, and the accuracy of the forecasting and planning that you're doing?
One of the things I'm trying to push our finance leadership team to do is position themselves more as business people. So I think as the role evolves now, I would try to argue, successfully or otherwise, that we are now business people with a finance background. And when you become business people with a finance background, I think there is a moment in time, a bit like the seek forgiveness thing, own your truth. I think there is a moment in time where you have to switch toward proactivity. So historically, again, I would argue finance were a bit reactive. It was a business has seen something. Business comes to finance with questions. Finance delivers a brilliant answer. Business goes away and cracks on. I would argue that that's not acceptable anymore. Finance has to be second guessing what's going to be happening all the time. And finance has to take the lead in already delivering a solution before the business has even realized the problem. And that very much is a seek forgiveness, not permission philosophy. But for me, that is what true leadership is all about. You know, that kind of attitude, then I think inherent within that is a make it happen attitude. I feel finance historically were asked, here's something exciting I would like to do. Crunch the numbers, does it add up? I'm not that interested in that way of thinking. I'm more interested in here's something the business would like to do. Right, what needs to be true for us to make this bring this to fruition? You know, do we have to remodel it? Do we have to renegotiate? Do we have to, you know, let's find a way. That's a far more energizing way of working. So I think it's more of a cultural transition actually to make all this happen now. And it's something I'm really passionate about this because I just find it interesting. It drives me more. I'm building a business rather than adding the numbers up for a business.
And that is inherently,
does that make sense?
Oh yeah, way more exciting and interesting, I think. But so, what does that change in terms of the skill set that your team need? Because that anticipatory mindset, like you say, spotting the problems before exists, it does mean moving away from, like we said, the lagging indicators, which we're looking at, which is P&L,
yeah,
and looking more at the data forms that perhaps we're not as comfortable with, and seeing what else is happening operationally within the business.
I think it is a huge requirement for EQ, quite frankly. Now, you know, we have a responsibility to be the holder of the truth now. And what that means is you need to be broadly aware of everything across an organization. You need your tentacles everywhere. But you also need to be able to understand genuinely what you're looking at. So I tend to recruit people. And I find it really hard to articulate this better, but I tend to recruit people that just get it. You know, they just understand how a business fits together like that. And that is worth 1,000 technical points, quite frankly. You know, it's just fundamentally understanding it. And once they're deeply integrated within a business, they will hear everything, they will see everything, they will challenge in the moment, report back and bring new ideas. So that's kind of where I'm trying to go with this is, I don't know, I feel like business partner is the wrong phrase now. I don't know what the right phrase is, by the way. But the next evolution of this is a business person that happens to have some level of reporting requirement along the way.
Yeah, And I think business partner in some ways doesn't, because there's such different varying skills, I think, within those that have that title. That's an interesting piece, isn't it, as well? And maybe within the concept of a business partner, finance business partner, we need almost a subset of specialisms depending on the individual. But yeah, I think.
But it's emotional intelligence, right? It's about understanding the human against you, or not against you, opposite you, and playing the person, not the cards, in a lot of instances. And that requires storytelling. It requires adaptability. potentially charisma to an extent, potentially strength. None of these are things you study with SEMA, ACA, ACCA. These are not technical skills, period. These are soft skills. But I think they're far more important to the ultimate success of your career than they ever were previously.
And I guess the question is, right, without sitting them down and making all of the candidates play a game of poker, how do you assess that skill set? How do you how do you personally do it? Because you said you just find people that just get it. How do you assess whether they get it?
I invest a lot of time in my relationship with my recruiters, first and foremost. So they get what makes my DNA and my finance ecosystems. Beyond that, I expect mainly the CVs to be quite homogenous, quite frankly. So an interview really is talking to a human and trying to spot them. I'm also a big believer in the interview process having a lot of different stakeholders, specifically of various levels. Because I'm super interested to know how someone interacts with someone that would report to them in an interview process. I also am particularly interested to know how the individual on the front desk is treated by that person. And then I will compare that to how they talk to the ultimate CEO in that interview. And if there is an inconsistency, period, they're not the one. You know, it's a human values thing, but they just clearly don't have their radar switched on to what the scenario is here.
That's super interesting. I think a lot of finance teams, that the bit that lets them down is that they have the right ideas, they know what they want from a finance person, but they don't quite get the recruitment right. And maybe that is a whole series in itself in terms of recruitment on that. So I'm very aware that this time has just disappeared, as I thought it might, James. And as it did last time, can I just say? So for those that are listening, there's obviously been some brilliant insights from you. And I think just hearing how you practically apply some of these big concepts that we all hear and talk about has been incredibly useful. But if you had to give some top tips to those looking to maybe reevaluate their, you know, their planning framework and look to implement a more robust planning process, what would those top tips be?
Good question. I think whatever your framework and frequency, I think make it repeatable, make it transparent. And specifically, I'd really double down on transparency, actually. So one of my philosophical things is I want absolutely no sandbagging anywhere in the organization. Because once you've got that, you end up with layers of it. And quite frankly, again, rubbish in, rubbish out. I've got nothing I can work with on the CEO. I can't make any informed investment decisions. So I think double down on the concept of transparency. Build a track record on the back of that of, you show me your truth and I will never beat you up for that, up or down. I think that's really, really important. You know, following through on that level of transparency and being aware of the shadow you cast as a leader is really important on that. Other than that, I think, yeah, it's a good question. I think concentrate on hearing what the question was in terms of, you've asked me to build a P&L forecast, a business case, whatever it may be that looks like this. Truly ask yourself, is this going to lead to the outcome they actually want? Because I see sometimes too many business cases that are written through the lens of, historically, we needed to hit 5x ROI across with this payback cycle. And they're just utterly deluded versus the reality of the business today. The world has moved on. So I think you've got to get how what you're putting together fits in contextually. But also I like the three-stage scenario planning of, you know, ambition, realism, and prudence. It works nicely for me. Might not work for everybody, but it certainly works for me.
And what I like about it is it's clearly defined and simple. I think there is a tendency in some of the budgeting cycles I've seen for, as you say, a lack of transparency or sandbagging is incredibly prevalent. And that doesn't do anybody any favors. You know, you have to unpick it at some point. You might as well do it at the beginning when you're putting together your cash flow forecast. But also, I like the simplicity of the model that three-step process. So thank you again, James. Genuinely appreciate your time, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. And to our listeners, if you feel like I missed a question, you want to go deeper into any of the topics we talked about today, because we have talked about a lot, as James and I have a tendency to do, then please do reach out and ask. And James, if people want to learn more about Kantar and also about, you know, yourself, where's the best place to find you?
So I'm quite active on LinkedIn. So if you type James Owen Seema, almost certainly I'm going to be the one that you find. There's not many of us out there. Kantar is kantar.com, KANTAR. We work with a lot of the world's largest companies.
Amazing. And for anybody listening, as usual, we'll put all of those links into the show notes to make it easy for you to find and put together. So thank you again, James. And thank you for sharing your insight, your knowledge, and the lessons that you've learned over the years. So it's great to hear and some really actionable tips for our listeners to take away. So thank you.
No problem. Thank you very much for inviting me again.
Hey, Google, what's the best accounting software for my business? Give it a couple of years, and I'll bet you she'll be able to answer you pretty accurately. But for now, it's still one of the few questions Google can't give you an answer for. But we can. Take our free quiz and find out which Sage product is the right fit for your business. Just head to itassolutions.co.uk.